Welcome to Ida History, the show that digs up the most thought-provoking stories from Idaho's history. Here are your hosts, Jeff Wade and Mark Iverson.
That's right, you are listening to Ida History. I'm Jeff, and sitting uncomfortably close to me is my BFF, Marky Mark.
What's up, Mark? How you doing? My name is Mark, and Jeff, you smell wonderful.
Thanks, I did take a shower right before we began.
Oh.
You know, spicy. Once a week at least.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, stick in a sponge.
Stick in a poke?
Poke in a stick.
Not sure what that means.
I don't either.
So, before we get into our episode today, I don't think we talked yet about our awesome music that we have on our podcast. Have we talked about that yet?
I don't think so. They're a cool band from Emmett, right?
That's right, yeah. So it's a band called Devil's County.
Wow!
Yeah, great name, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So the song is called Highway 55, and it's all about going from the small town to the city of trees and having a little fun. So it's a great tune. So we'd like to thank Devil's County for letting us use that song for our podcast music. But yeah, they're a great band. Check them out on Spotify or I'm sure Apple Music, wherever you get your music, I think they're on. So
support local music and definitely history. Support us, please.
Just threw my devil horns in the air to that.
Devil horns in the air. Wave them around like you just don't care.
We got to remember sometimes it's a podcast and people can't see what we're doing.
Oh, here. That's right. Yeah.
Speaking of what we're doing here, let's get into this episode today, Mark.
Let's get into the meat. The meat of the history.
The meaty bits.
The meaty bits. The hangy bits. The jibbly bits.
All right. Let's do that. So, Mark, you know, we both kind of have particular interests in history, and, you know, I'm sure most people do, right? Some people enjoy the history of knitting.
Or I do.
Cheese making.
Yes.
Or prostitutes.
Definitely. They go well together. Prostitutes, knitting, cheesemongering.
I'm sure there's a lot of knitting going on in brothels. The times were slow.
Yeah, there is. I have a story, but I'll save that.
But yeah, we talked more about that, I think, in our last episode. Or maybe it's our next episode. We'll figure that out.
Yeah.
We'll record it
but after this, but we'll air it first. So
we totally know what we're doing. Anyway, prostitutes. Oh, wait, no. So now it's my turn. So, Mark, since I started this journey, I have kind of always been interested in the Civil War in the Pacific Northwest, especially, of course, here in Idaho, because there's a lot about it that people do not know.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. People will be like, the Civil War? Pacific Northwest, you do say? And, so I guess in the Civil War, Idaho is kind of the red-headed stepchild of the Union and Confederates during the Civil War. So what is it that interests you about this kind of like specific part of this particular topic?
You know, just because I think it's an area that hasn't really been studied or discussed much. And it really hasn't been portrayed in the popular media at all. You know, we talk about slavery, John Brown, Fort Sumter, Gettysburg, and the Lincoln assassination, which all are very important events. But what's happening here in the West was equally important to the war effort. You know, Mark, back in the fourth grade, you know, we had Idaho history class, and we talked about the trappers, we talked about gold mines, we talked about, Native American stuff, but we'd never really talked about the Civil War and why it was so important to Idaho. And it was important to Idaho history because it's the reason why Idaho became a territory. And, you know, I think we're going to talk about that more as we kind of go on with the show. But this topic today, I think it's a good place to start.
So what exactly are we talking about in this episode?
So we're going to talk about the 1864 election in Boise City, Idaho Territory. Not only that, we're going to talk about the possibility that it was largely, and I hate to use this term, but stolen by Southern Democrats.
Well now, Jeff, that's quite the accusation. Do you have evidence to back this claim up?
I sure do, Mark. And actually, you helped dig up some of that evidence at the Idaho City Archive. But before we get heavily into that, let's kind of back it up and talk a little bit about the origins of Idaho and how it came to be split between Northerners and Southerners in Idaho. Mark, why don't you tell us a little bit about the gold and then our hills?
In them, there are hills. Yes, always in the hills, but not really always in the hills, frequently in the hills. So I don't think anybody will be surprised when I say, you know, gold is pretty much the reason Idaho exists, is a thing, is a state. We all know, and not just in Idaho, but, you know, in everywhere American history, that Lewis and Clark came out west at the core of discovery in, what, 1884? 1885, they come through where Idaho is.
And, something like that, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. And they make their way down to Snake River and, right? And then some rivers, and they get to the Pacific, and it's all easy from there on out.
Right.
But they eventually, they survive, and they go back east, and they have maps and notes. And so the fur traders, right? John Jacob Astor, Astoria, great town, failed fur venture, Goonies, you know, forever. But anyway, so some fur trappers come through the Boise Valley, through Idaho, all over the place, really. And so we learn about that, you know, the first economy, kind of like large-scale economic kind of movement in American history. It comes through here. And then you have Captain Elias D. Pierce. Later, he discovers gold up in the Nez Perce Reservation in 1860. And then, you know, they find gold on the Salmon River in 1861. These stories deserve their own episodes, definitely. Big moments in Idaho history. But in the Boise Basin in August of 1862, a dude named George Grimes, he finds gold up there on Grimes Creek. What a quinky-dink, eh?
Right.
Yeah. And then he dies. He's shot. And he's still buried up there. Jeff and I have been up there. Pretty cool place.
Tried to dig him up, but the ground was too frozen.
I know, right? Yeah. We needed a pry bar, really. Right. Rocks. So anyway, you know, they find gold in the Owyhee Mountains. And, you know, eventually they founded the Idaho Territory in March of 1863. But, Jeff, what else was going on?
Well, Mark, you know, on April 12th, 1861, there was some dudes with some cannons and guns and stuff, and they started shooting at a place called Fort Sumter in South Carolina. And these men were Confederates, basically. But this action kicked off the United States Civil War. This is about 6 months after the first gold discovery happened in Idaho, and the war would last all the way till 1865. So you have this situation where the first few years of Idaho's existence, the Civil War was waging on the other side of the continent. Idaho Territory was created with the intent to be able to protect the gold mines from Confederate conspiracies, of which there are quite a few going on in the Pacific Northwest at the time.
What?
Yeah. Crazy. Damn. Crazy, huh? So I'm going to give a couple examples, and I could talk about this all day because, again, this is my favorite subject, but I'm going to try to give you a real quick, you know, lesson here. The actual cause of the actual outbreak of the Civil War was the 1860 presidential election. So, Mark, why don't you tell us about the 1860 presidential election?
All right. So the Democrats, in some say a move of stupidity.
I say.
Yeah, it probably was. Split their party into the Northern and the Southern factions. Northern Dems were more about letting slavery continue on as it had been and was. But the Southern Dems were all about fighting hard to keep it going. And of course, you had a Republican candidate. I know it's a little flippy, but the guy from Illinois who liked to wear the top hat, if you will.
He had a sweet beard later.
He had a sweet beard. Yeah. Old Abraham Lincoln, the abolitionist. You know, abolition being a little different than I think we think of, but Abe was an abolitionist prior to, you know, that was one of his big running points, right? But the Southern Democrats nominated a guy named John see Breckinridge for. I mean, we all know of Breckinridge, don't we?
Of course, he still hasn't faded from history.
He's the guy. And his running mate was a fellow named Joseph Lane. And Lane was super pro Confederate. Like, he'd be the guy in the pickup truck with Confederate flags waving, probably right next to the American flag. Not back then, though, not. He'd just be straight up Confederate flag.
Yeah.
Okay. And it blows smoke all over in your face, and he's like, that's freedom, right? But he had also served as a major figure in the Rogue River War in Oregon. I'm sure you all know about that. And he was an Oregon territorial governor and an Oregon territorial senator. And he was, you know, I think it might not surprise people to know that he was a Ducks fan.
Of course.
A good football team, but the most jackassy fans in the Pac-12, soon to be the Big Ten. I don't know what's going on. Anyway, most Confederates were Duck fans. It's just a true thing.
Yeah. That's why they call that game every year the Civil War, right?
Because exactly. Right. Yeah, the Battle of Quackersville.
The Quackers.
Quackersville.
So, yeah, in addition to all that, Joseph Lane was actually a key figure of a group called the Knights of the Golden Circle.
Like Camelot?
It's just a model.
Oh, okay.
So the KGC started actually before the war as, quote, Southern Rights Clubs, because slavery, as we all know, was outlawed in the 1810s, or the international slave trade, anyway, was outlawed. So the slavery as an institution was kind of, a lot of people thought it was fading away by the time you get to the Civil War.
But you got chattel slavery kind of coming along because of the outlawing, right?
Exactly. So what that means is basically a slave has a child and that child also becomes a slave. So that was the only way slavery was being continued at the time. Well, and then the illegal slave trade, of course. But the point being that a lot of Southern men at the time thought that their way of life was being threatened. So they organized these Southern Rights Clubs to kind of, you know, push their political and business interests. Anyway, so this Knights of the Golden Circle group, they started as Southern Rights Clubs, but they morphed into this large organization that had their sights set on taking over a large chunk of the Western Hemisphere and turning it into a slavery empire. But during the war, they kind of went underground and became spies and secret agents for the Confederate government.
So you're saying Joseph Lane, the guy who almost became vice president, was a member of this secret Confederate, dare I say, cult?
But yeah, he and a lot of other people out here in the West at the time were members of this group. And I want to clarify that not all people who harbored Southern sympathies were members of this organization, but many actually were. Either way, though, they left their mark not only on the Pacific Northwest, but Idaho as well.
True. There are many places in Idaho that bear Southern names. Leesburg, Dixie, Secesh River, Atlanta, Confederate Gulch. That one's a little on the nose, Confederate Gulch.
Right, yeah. It's...
Grayback Gulch and Davisburg. Okay, that one's not real. That brings us to Standifer Street in Placerville up in the Boise Basin. And I just know a guy who wrote a book on Jeff Standifer, and his name is Jeff Wade, J.D. Wade.
That's me, I guess. So yeah, I sure did. I wrote a book about this guy named Jefferson J. Standifer. So he was the first sheriff of Idaho County. He led the third party of men into the Boise Basin to find gold. He also helped build, if you've ever been up to Placerville, there's a building on the main plaza there. It's called Magnolia Saloon. I think it's now a little museum. But that is one of the original buildings, original structures in the Boise Basin. I think it goes all the way back to 1863. But Jeff Standifer had a hand in building the saloon. And then in March of 1863, he put together a party of men to, quote, punish the natives that were attacking the wagon trains into the area. So you had a situation where these miners were trying to establish their mines, but to do that, you need supplies. Unfortunately, the natives were attacking all of the wagon trains that were coming into the mines. So they couldn't get the supplies they needed. The stuff that was getting through, the prices were ridiculously high. So Stanifer's Rangers, as they were called, they left Idaho City just a few days before Idaho became a territory, and they ended up fighting several engagements with what, at the time, they called the Snake Indians. Now we call them Bannock, Northern Paiute, Shoshone.
And so this was before Fort Boise, right? The one not in Parma for fur trading, but the one in the city of Boise, the military post. That was July of 1863, wasn't it?
Yeah, 4th of July, right, is when it was officially.
Yeah, exactly. Same days Gettysburg was being fought. Mm-hmm. So what happened when the military came here?
So Colonel Pinckney Luganbiel, I think he was colonel at the time, right? And later,
I thought he was a major, and then later he became a colonel.
I'm trying to remember my military ranks now. But yeah, no, I think you're right.
I am.
Okay, good.
Maybe, but now you're going to look, and then later you'll tell me. On air, I hope.
Okay. Either way, so Pinckney Luganbiel, he commanded this contingent of troops. And so, yeah, so when Pinckney Luganbiel and his troops rolled into town, they had actually had two sets of orders, right? So one was to, like we just talked about, build a fort, which, you know, Fort Boise, you can go see some of those buildings still.
So they played softball there in the 1860s, from what I understand.
Softball?
What else?
I don't know if you're joking about that, or...
Cricket? No, that's more of a British thing.
Right.
Polo. Horse polo.
Polo.
Not water polo, yes. Horse polo.
Well, they did do that, for sure.
Anyway, I digress.
I hope you digest, too.
I digest while I digress.
Okay. Anyway, so like I said, the first set of orders was to build a fort, and the second set of orders that they had from General Alvord was to disperse Stanifer's Rangers, because they feared that it was a, quote, secessionist militia. And it actually probably was, because Jeff Stanifer, the leader of this group, was a member of the Knights of the Golden Circle.
You're saying they're secession?
They sure are.
They ain't Billy Yank. They are Johnny Rebs, huh? They
got gray in their blood.
Gray in their blood.
So that's also something that we need to do maybe an episode or two on. But anyway, let's move on to the year after that in 1864 and the election in October of that year, which is the actual topic of this episode.
Okay, so to set the stage for this election, Boise City was... Did I say that right? Boise.
Man, I've gotten torn up about that before.
Boise. Just as a quick little thing, my neighbor down the street, and a couple of times I was, I had spent quite some time scooping or shoveling snow out of her driveway, and I was having a conversation with her mother, who thanked me for doing that. But I said, Boise, and she was like, if you're gonna move here, you might as well learn how to say it. And I was like, well, okay, Boise. And guess who is never going to shovel your daughter's driveway ever again? But anyway, you know, I digress.
I was born and raised here, and I still don't say it right half the time, so
I guess I should get back to what we were talking about. But Fort Boise was established, and then the city of Boise was platted just a few days later by some of the founding fathers, Thomas Davis, husband to Julia Davis, and all. You know, what's the guy with the cabin on Fort Street? You know, the old cabin, the oldest building in Boise.
Oh, Farrell.
Yeah, Will Farrell. Will Farrell, that's right. Will Farrell. But anyway, so it was a supply point between the Boise Basin and the Owyhee Mines, and it was kind of on an offshoot of the Oregon Trail, Goodall's Cutoff. So it was a great location, and farms and ranches started to develop in the area, and so this became a mercantile hub. I call it a mining supply town. But it was decided to hold the election there in 1864, and it happened in October of 1864. And on the ballot were several county-level offices, such as, the auditor, county clerk, county treasurer, and the sheriff, as well as a territorial auditor and treasurer. But the most important race was the territorial representative to the U.S. Congress. And so this would be the man who would go to Washington to represent all of the Idaho territory. So it was a critical race. And I do intentionally say man, because in these days, women weren't in that game, obviously.
It's true. So I think, Mark, we've got a kind of a good setup for our story here. So why don't we take a quick commercial break, and then we'll come on back and we'll talk more about this election. Sound good?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, here we go.
Jeff, I'm not sure you're aware, but we're in the history business.
Oh, yeah?
The Ida history business. And we go to lots of historic sites, and we always talk about how best to preserve them. You got any ideas?
You know, one way is 3D scanning, and there's a great company based right here in Boise, Idaho, called Datum Tech Solutions.
Do tell.
Datum Tech Solutions can sell and rent survey equipment and construction technology such as total stations, GPS location tools, drones, and 3D scanners. They also train people how to use them. Mark, these services are used by general contractors, mechanical and plumbing companies, architects, engineers, public safety organizations, and historical societies. So if you want to know more about Datum Tech Solutions, visit their website at datumtechsolutions.com. Hey, Mark, I'm trying to find a book. Do you know any bookstores in this area?
I do, Jeff. Right in downtown Meridian, a soon-to-be a brick-and-mortar store coming in 2023. It's called Pearl House Collective, and it's a woman-owned independent bookstore featuring big stories from the small presses. We can appreciate that.
Sounds great.
And, you know, Pearl House connects you with dynamic, enriching texts that you'll want to share with your family and friends. And Pearl House hosts the Banned Book Club of Boise, where community members read recently challenged and banned books and discuss them nicely. So join the community online at Pearl House Collective and at Boise Banned Book Club. Hey, Jeff, do you have any murder houses with blood dripping down the walls that need sold and need sold quickly?
I might after this weekend.
Fantastic. I have two ladies that are just right for the job. Melissa Call, my friend and fellow Washingtonian, and Kara Harwick, Eagleite from Eagle, Idaho. They've teamed up, and they're a member of Birch Leaf Real Estate out of Eagle, Idaho. And these ladies can... they can sell your home quick, whether somebody's been murdered there or not. To learn more, go to www.birchleafgroup.com or reach Melissa or Kara at 208-254-0490.
All right, and we are back, Mark.
Live and full of jive. That's stupid.
Vigor and whim.
Vigor and whim. Whimsy.
That too. So we're yeah. So we're talking about the Boise City election in October of 1864. We're talking about kind of the run-up to that election. There was a lot of back and forth in the newspapers between the Democrats and Republicans. I mean, nothing changes in that regard, right?
Yeah.
So the Republicans started calling themselves the Union Party, probably as a way to take a moral high ground against the treasonous Dems. So, Mark, can you read that quote from the Idaho Statesman on September 20th, 1864?
Sure, Jeff. The title of this news item is Union Men Rally. And so it reads, "The approaching election should warn every true and loyal Union man to be at his post in this time of our country's peril. It is no time to cry peace, but let the Union Party with one united shout proclaim the battle cry of freedom. The coming political contest is an important one to the future interests of Idaho Territory. Let us be, by our actions, words, and votes, say that Idaho, the gem of the mountains, the young, fairest, and most beautiful of her sister territories, is true to the common cause and is in favor of union, and opposed to the surrender of the rights of the citizens of the United States to any self-constituted and self-styled Southern chivalry or Knights of the Golden Circle. Ha ha!
Excellent. Excellent reading there, Mark.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
You're going to have to use that voice for all my newspaper quotes from now on.
Indubitably.
So, yeah, but I think this passage kind of shows that the people of Idaho Territory were very much aware of the threat that secessionists could carry the territory away from the path of statehood. And so the election was actually held on Monday, October 10th, 1864. And, you know, there are some fears that there would be some violence at the polls, but fortunately that did not happen. But something kind of untoward did occur during the election. And Mark, you found the document that kind of set us off on looking into that. Can you tell us about the John Z. White letter?
Well, yeah. Yeah, so basically, old John described the scene as the citizens of Boise City for what it was at that time. You know, whatever it was at that time, a city, a town, a village.
Not much.
Not much, right? You got, like, five saloons.
Yeah.
And maybe a few mercantiles or brothels, which were basically, I don't know, you laid on an old mattress in the back and it was made of freaking straw. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But they were harassed by Price's army. The voters were harassed by this Price's army, quote, end quote. And it was basically a paramilitary crew that made haste from Missouri, right? After the Battle of Westport, largely, which was, what was that called? The Gettysburg of the West?
Yeah.
So it was a big cavalry battle that happened there in 1864, right? But White estimated, the author of this letter, he basically estimated that 600 of these Price's army cadets, I'm sure this is an overstatement or an overestimate, made trouble and kept folks in Boise City from voting.
Yeah, so that's kind of interesting, that letter, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was just, sometimes you kind of, I'd like to say I was some genius in the archives and I was like, look at this, it's exactly what I was looking for. But no, I just saw an old cool letter and I had looked up riot and 1864 election, which really didn't happen.
But yeah, he uses that riot, that term riot, but riot doesn't always mean what we think it does. You know, a riot can just be any kind of like disorderly conduct, that type of thing.
So are we talking like Guar concert, Motorhead style riot, you know, maybe a good Rage Against the Machine raging. What are we talking about here?
Well, you know, Rage Against the Machine would come to Boise a few years later.
Oh yeah, what, 1866, right?
Yep, exactly.
Or was it 1996?
Yeah, so so White mentions that these men were from, he called it Price's Army, right? So I want to do a quick overview on what that exactly means. So there's a dude named Sterling Price. He gained some military experience during the Mexican-American War, where he led a cavalry unit from Missouri. And there's a story that he, during the Mexican-American War, like the Treaty of, is it the Treaty of Hidalgo?
Guadalupe Hidalgo?
Yeah, that's what it was. Okay. Had been signed. And so he had orders not to invade this, I think it was Chihuahua. And then for some reason he thought that the rebels or whoever in Chihuahua were going to attack into the United States. So against orders, he took his cavalry troops down and invaded this Mexican state right after the treaty. And he was aware that the treaty had been signed. But he actually was praised by President Polk for his actions there.
So, just polking around.
Yeah. Polk that. So anyway, his military successes helped him get elected as the governor of Missouri in 1852. He served until the year of 1857. So when the southern states actually started to secede from the Union, Price actively campaigned to keep Missouri in the Union. And there's kind of some indication that he was kind of playing both sides, like he maybe was just trying to go with whatever side he thought might have been the winner. If you're interested in this, like, I can't really, you know, we can't really go into much more detail in this kind of this episode, but it's a fascinating story if you're interested in the Civil War at all. Anyway, so when the Union troops under Captain Nathaniel Lyons entered Missouri, Price was given command of what they called the Missouri State Guard, which was the state militia. After that initial skirmish that the State Guard fought with Union troops, the Union Army was actually able to overrun the State Guard and take control of most of Missouri, and the Union would hold Missouri throughout most of the war. So now that their homes were in control of the federal troops, the soldiers of Price's armies were ordered to join the rest of the Confederate forces and continue the fight.
So most of these men didn't sign up to fight for the Confederate States of America. You know, they were fighting to protect their homes because, you know, whether the Union cause is just or not, you have to look at it from that day and age of a state's rights kind of thing, you know.
Each state was pretty much its own country at the time.
Exactly. You know, Robert E. Lee, in the end, turned down a commission to lead the Union Army and went to fight for his home state of Virginia.
You know, it's funny you mentioned Robert E. Lee. Because we're talking about the Knights of the Golden Circle. He was actually held captive by KGC members in Texas for a while.
No.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Why?
So there was kind of that time period where, you know, the states were seceding. He was offered a commission by President Lincoln to lead the Union Army. Mm-hmm. And I think when these members of the KGC... kidnapped him, basically. They were trying to convince him to fight for the South, which he eventually did.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, it was about your state. You know, we think of America as a whole, you know, but then it was very much like it was a union of states instead of a nation of states. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, because if we look at the word state, it refers to more of an autonomous political entity. Like if we were talking about, like, say, the Balkan states or, you know, European states, they're like their own countries.
Yeah, so exactly. And so, you know, when as they saw it, the federal army invaded Missouri, you know, they were going to fight for their homes. And so, you know, some of these guys did own slaves, but we're not talking about the large plantations that come to mind. You know, we're talking about what would be like a westernized version of slavery. These aren't wealthy plantation owners for the most part, although they're wealthy men. So they were fighting oftentimes for their, you know, for their little hamlet, their area. And so there's a great book called Woe to Live On. And I forget the author's name, but it is an awesome book. Turned into a movie called Ride with the Devil by Ang Lee. And it shows you what the Civil War was like between like the Kansas and the Missouri area. Very violent. Think Northern Ireland, assassinations and things like that.
Talk about the Jayhawkers.
The Jayhawkers. Jayhawkers. The Jayhawkers. And the Bushwhackers, the Missouri boys. You know, so anyway, I digress, but...
don't digress quite yet, because I kind of want to mention that that's kind of the environment that led to like the rise of like Jesse James and kind of the outlaws and what you really think about like the Old West.
Yeah. So the lines weren't so clearly drawn in Missouri and Kansas or the West, but you know what you had, especially in there was a conflict going on called Bleeding Kansas before, and it all had to do with how slavery would continue on in the West. Would it continue on in the West? You know, Kansas, it was not a slave state. It was an abolition state. Missouri was. And so you had killings and brutalities going on before. And so you had these outlaws who knew how to ride horses, use pistols. They knew the land. And they knew how to ambush people. So you had atrocities. And, you know, you had this tit for tat kind of thing that had already developed prior to the Civil War. And so this continued on and got worse. So a lot of these guys learn how to rob, fight, and just be ruthless, like the James Gang. Or, well, my favorite is he died, but Bloody Bill Anderson. Right. What a bad, but also mystifying, mysterious, interesting guy.
Yeah.
Quantrell's Raiders. Mm-hmm. Lawrence, Kansas, the raid on Lawrence, Kansas. But these guys, some of these guys, if I'm right, were in Price's army.
Right.
These kind of folks.
And actually, while we're on that subject and talking about kind of Confederacy Confederate Sperry's in the Pacific Northwest, Cole Younger, who was Jesse James's cousin, right?
Yeah, the Younger gang. There were a few, right?
So, yeah, I think they were cousins to the James boys. But the James and Youngers kind of formed a mega gang after a while.
Yeah, right.
So they called it the James Younger gang. Cole Younger actually helped a Confederate spy get from Texas to California through Mexico and then up to Vancouver, Canada, to help get some documents to the British government so the Confederacy could purchase ships that they called commerce raiders. So the goal was that they would have their ships docked on Vancouver Island and actually come down and attack the gold shipments and stuff like that on the West Coast.
Wow. That's
another one of those little conspiracies.
Prior to this, I had no idea what you're talking about. Okay. Right? Yeah.
Actually, there was...
But that's so interesting.
Yeah, there's quite a few Confederate sympathizers in British Columbia to the point where there's actually stars and bars flying. The Confederate flag was actually flying in some places in British Columbia.
Yeah, I think Jeff and I are showing our... We love to talk about the Civil War because while it's clear it... in these times that slavery is wrong and that the enslaved peoples of the United States definitely deserve their freedom. For people back then, not everybody saw it as clearly as we see it now, you know, especially like abolitionists, right? We talk about Abe Lincoln, but Abe Lincoln in his own letters was a colonist or colonialist type view where he did not think white people and black people could live together. And so he wanted, you know, either to send black populations out west where they could be black Americans there or to Africa because he thought coexistence wasn't possible, though they deserve their freedom. And so, you know, Idaho presents us this chance to look at these very unexplored ideas about the Civil War where we can kind of reframe it how people back then saw it. And so Price's army comes from these roots, right? And they were, anyway, you know, we're talking about the West. And so to go West, you know, it was an annual migration, right? And so Price's army, these are some of those immigrants that White referred to go back to White and his letter talking about the election in Boise City. White is referring to these immigrants, these particular immigrants. But to get to the sources, where we always go to the either really good secondary source material from historians or we go to the primary materials. So we can't just take one man's small letter that he wrote as if that's the God's honest truth. So what else do you have, Jeff, to prove that there was election fraud?
So about 3 days after the election, a news item appeared in the Idaho Statesman. So basically this news item was claiming that a large number of immigrants had voted in the election despite not meeting the residency requirements. A person had to have resided in the territory for a certain amount of time to be eligible to vote. So that's what we're talking about when we talk about this, quote, election fraud, is people that were not eligible to vote actually voting in this election. And then on October 25th, another full column story reiterates these claims and adds that most of these immigrants had been members of Price's army. The paper goes on to note that Union men of the territory were defeated by about 600 votes, which can only be accounted for by the immigrant vote. And that number, 600, just happens to line up with what John Z. White mentioned in his letter.
So it might not be an overestimate.
It might not be.
Oh, wow.
I mean, we're talking about there were thousands of people on the Oregon Trail coming out west during this time period. So I don't think it's much of a stretch to say 600 or so might have been Missourians that were coming out west.
It's funny, you know, this brings to mind, just to cut you off, but it's funny to think, you know, we look at today as the only time in American history, or, you know, a lot of people think, like, what's going on in America today? Allegations of fraud, voter fraud, you know, no opinion thrown out on that. But what I'm saying is that happened all the time.
It's nothing new.
It's sensationalism in the paper, doctored up facts, you know. that's how we've always been easy humans to manipulate and basically herd into one side or the other. You know, democracy is chock full of cheating. Yeah. And some say, who's the guy? With Thaddeus Stevens, right? To go to Lincoln and the Emancipation Proclamation. There was quite, if you've seen Spielberg's movie about Lincoln, there was quite a bit of fraud involved in that. although I'm very glad that that happened because it needed to.
Right.
But, you know, hey, they cheated to get to that very important, needed step.
It's true. So the statesman goes on actually to say that many of the members of Price's armies, after voting illegally in Idaho, or, you know, Boise, Idaho Territory, they moved on, they kept moving west, and they influenced elections in Oregon, especially in Wasco, Umatilla, and Baker counties. And, you know, I checked the election returns on those elections as well, and they all did happen to vote Democrat in the presidential election, which was the month after the election that we're talking about in Boise.
Is there any other, you know, proof that these members of Price's army wound up in Oregon?
Price's army, how they rolled through Boise, possibly influenced the 1864 election, and then moved on into Oregon. I mentioned that they were in some of those eastern counties in Oregon and how they influenced their elections as well. Mark, you asked me if there's any other proof that some of these members of Price's armies wound up there. And I was about to tell you before commercial break that there really is. So it's kind of interesting. We do research projects for, you know, clients if they want their family histories, property histories, stuff like that done.
If people's houses are haunted, that's always fun.
We actually did find the possible identity of a ghost recently. That was fun.
That was kind of fun. And she was happy. Our client was happy.
I think so.
The man in the attic.
I don't think we've ever not made a client happy.
Well, not in the history profession.
Okay. So I was working on one of our projects recently for one of our favorite customers. Her name is Tammy Guzman.
Shout out to Tammy, man.
Yeah, Tammy. It's great. Tammy. So Tammy's, I think it was her second great-grandfather, was buried in a cemetery called Wingville Cemetery, which is outside of Baker City, Oregon. So the community of Wingville is actually named after these members of Price's army, which were referred to as, I've seen it referred to as either the left or right wing of Price's army. So if you look up Wingville Cemetery and find a grave, you'll actually see a lot of Confederate headstones there.
Yeah, I mean, they were out in the West just winging it.
Winging it.
Figuring out how they're going to survive, mm-hmm. Maybe spread the Confederacy.
Is that a Wings song you were just singing?
My favorite Paul McCartney band. What the hell am I talking about, Jeff? I don't know. So we have a couple of primary sources. Essentially, you know, a letter, the white letter, and the newspaper accounts from the time period. And that say... members of Price's army influenced the 1864 election vote in Boise City. And so basically, you know, a primary source is from that day and age. You know, you get, you know, letters from people, correspondence between different politicians, oral histories or interviews, you know, things like that. Newspaper articles. Anybody
really in a position to witness the events for themselves.
Exactly. But we also have used, you know, credible secondary sources, and secondary sources are like, you know, professors of history, you know, local historians that have practiced it their whole life, archivists, whatever. And they look at good primary source material and then they analyze it and then chalk it up in their book and explain it to you, hopefully in an entertaining package. And this is secondary material. And then they footnote the sources that they use, you know, basically listing out everything in their book.
Kind of like we did in our book, Murder, Man, and Boise, which is available wherever you get your books.
Yeah, Jeff, that's chock full of great primary source material about the most horrible shit we could find.
That's correct.
Jeff is a king at finding the weirdest, wackiest, and most mayhem-filled stories, and so we filled a book with some of the craziest stories we could find.
That's right, and we're following it up with another book about ghost stories.
Oh, yeah. Haunted America, Boise. You know, we've definitely gone to the primary materials on that one. You know, Jeff looked into Satanism in the hills and dark spirits and how people felt, in the 1960s, 70s, 80s?
Yeah.
About satanic panic. Satanic
panic.
Satanic panic. Sounds like a band.
It would be a great band.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We are Satanic Panic, Boise.
But anyway, like a mashup, like Satanic Panic at the Disco.
Oh yeah, Satanic Panic at the Disco. Oh, that's great. I looked into the Boise Murder House or the Chop Chop House.
Oh my god!
Right,
that's such a crazy story.
Yeah, but I've noticed that everybody, you know, there are those that look into it and say, "Hey, it wasn't a frat house," because it wasn't. College kids did live there, but some people just throw out the BS and they want to, you know, oh, this is the story, but people take that and they believe that really happened.
And then it gets repeated.
And then it gets repeated. And then people.
Through all these like podcasts and books that we've read on this subject, like they're just saying the same thing, but they're not going back to these primary sources
exactly.
And checking the facts.
Yeah, it was actually a really well done podcast called Dark House, and they did a whole series or a whole episode on this. Boise Murder House. They did a pretty good job, but they said that they thought it was probably a lore or one of those local kind of legends that said the house was built by sandstone from Table Rock. And I was like, oh, hey, no, that's BS. Yeah, that is definitely Table Rock sand, stone, you know? So I looked into that and I found, you know, the home does date back to like 1910 and that, you know, it was like an old folks home. And there's stories of a haunting that doesn't have to do with what happened there in 1987. But we look into that, you know. And so really can't do all that cool stuff without primary source material. And we want to be great secondary source material based on that primary source material. But anyway,
which we're lucky to have a few sources like that for Idaho, right?
You know, yeah. And so there are some, and you have to have a kind of critical eye when you read them, but they are old, old secondary sources. Like there are a couple classic texts about Idaho, you know, John Haley's aptly named The History of Idaho and James Hawley's, History of Idaho, Gem of the Mountains.
So get that colon in there.
Oh, yeah.
History of Idaho, colon, Gem of the Mountains.
I mean, I think he should clear his colon. Yes. You know, maybe just put a comment. Whatever. Anyway, it's good.
You seem and like a guy that ate a lot of fatty foods.
Yeah. Yeah, no. like modern art on a wall, you know what I mean? I mean, okay, cut that part out. Yeah. But anyway, and then there's also a great, I would call it, if it's the McConnell, William McConnell book that I'm thinking of, History of Idaho, is that where he describes his vigilante days and all that?
He mentions himself in the third person in this one, which is kind of weird to read. But he...
Like Bob Dole. I'm Bob Dole. Bob Dole likes you.
Yes. He has several other books. One's called, I think it might be the one you're thinking of, is called Frontier Justice.
Oh, yeah, that's the one. Yes. And I do think he was a badass guy, but he's always honorable and just and completely paints himself as, you know, the Western badass,
yep.
Clint Eastwood type.
Yeah.
But it's great information.
It is.
Yeah, yeah. And so we love those kind of things. But anyway, in these sources, all three of them, they talk about Price's army in Idaho. Haley relied on letters and interviews with people who actually witnessed these things happen and the events that Haley was writing about. He has a letter from a guy named J.S. Butler, who, along with his brother, started the Boise News. And it was the first newspaper in the southern part of the territory, Idaho Territory. After more than a year, they sold the paper to these Southern Democrats who wanted their own paper. And he says it was during the most exciting times of the rebellion, and the parties here were formed on the questions involved in that great issue. And as a great many of Price's army, when it disbanded, found their way to Idaho, that the party prevailed. And so after the paper that quote just came from, after the paper was sold, it was changed. The name was changed to the Idaho World from Idaho City, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And so Hawley's history pretty much just copies Haley's on this matter.
So it's interesting when you read, you take the Idaho Statesman and the Idaho World and you put them next to each other on the same topics. The Statesman was Republican owned. The Idaho World was Democrat owned. So they obviously disagree with each other on a lot of events. They go back and forth for sometimes weeks on a certain subject.
Oh, these dude hated each other.
They did. They did. And it's awesome to read these. And it's just like this rivalry that these two newspapers had. It's awesome to read some stuff.
And yeah, it's like desperate housewives that hate each other, just like slamming each other. And
a lot of drama.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll talk about the vigilantes later on. We'll talk more about kind of that rivalry because it really pops up during the vigilante episodes in southern Idaho.
Yeah.
Speaking of vigilantes, William J. McConnell was actually a vigilante, and that's one of the reasons that I like talking about him so much. He's an interesting guy, like Mark said. But in his book, McConnell, he goes more into depth, and I like this quote. It's quite lengthy, but I love his writing style, and he actually puts it into perfect context. So kind of bear with us on this long quote. So McConnell says, during the interval that had elapsed since the election of Wallace, and he's referring to the first territorial governor, William Wallace.
William Wallace?
Not the Scottish guy.
Freedom!
Exactly.
That guy?
I knew you were going to do that when I talked about him. So he says, during the interval that had elapsed since the election of Wallace, what was known then as the, quote, left wing of Price's army had been scattering its red plumes and feathers all over the vast Intermountain region at that time embraced within the boundaries of Idaho Territory. The warriors composing this contingent of the Confederate Army, having become tired of the restraints and hardships of military life and the apparently hopeless task of confronting the hordes of, quote, northern abolitionists who continued to invade and overrun their fair land.
Northern aggressor.
They had concluded to resign in a body and migrate westward, where the more congenial task of taking charge of the political destiny of Idaho awaited them. And so they came and continued to come, with ox whip in one hand and the ballot in the other, and by frequent and persistent voting soon changed the complexion of things political. Mark, why don't you help me out with the rest of that? Your best McConnell voice.
Well, the foraging is probably right so far as the political affiliations of these overland arrivals is concerned, yet it is a mistake to credit all of them, or, for that matter, any great number of them, with having belonged formerly to the Confederate Army. A few had possibly, at one time, followed some Confederate leader, but nearly all of them were refugees trying to escape the horrors of civil war. Husbands and wives, their children, and such of their possessions as they had rescued from the wrecks of their former homes, turned westward, in fact, fled from the intestine strife which was dotting the land with graves. They came in hope of finding peace rather than to engage in contests of political or otherwise.
Well, I really like how he talks. He says, he basically goes over what we were just talking about, how it's not a black and white thing. There's a lot of gray area going on here.
Although, you know, really, when it comes down to it, the Civil War was very much a black and white thing.
Oh my God.
That's leaving. A bad joke. Okay, you should punch me. Will you punch me on the chin?
If I could reach you, I could. So McConnell goes on to say that these people being war refugees only voted along the same lines they would have voted at home. And then he talks about how his father was a free soil abolitionist and how he himself was a Republican in these days. Free soil abolitionist, Mark, does that mean that they were basically wanting to open up the West to settlement and give them free land, right?
Yeah, basically.
Of course, McConnell himself was a Republican. And then he goes on, he says, but, quote, I met these people in both social and business way, and I stand ready now, as I did then, to voice for the man estimable qualities and lovable characteristics of those who were called, quote, the left wing of Parsi's army. Now, McConnell also goes on to talk about how the Democratic Party in Idaho elected a lot of lawless and bad men, but it was not because that, you know, overall they were bad people. It was because the bulk of them only voted in general elections and had nothing to do with the nominations or party primaries. And, you know, McConnell knew a thing or two about Idaho politics because he was our third state governor.
So, you know, and of course, this led to the election. Well, I say, of course, to Jeff, because we know this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But it led to the election of our first Ada County sheriff that will have to save his story for another date. But his name was David Updike. He was the first Ada County sheriff, as I said, and he was what arguably could be labeled as a piece of shit.
Yes.
Yes.
Agreed.
So, yeah, anyway, there's one last aspect to this story that we need to cover. But, Jeff, you mentioned that a lot of these Price's army folks moved to Oregon, but not all of them did. Some of these guys settled west of Boise City on the Boise River. They called the area Dixie, but now we call it Caldwell. The Dixie name survives in, you know, the form of the Dixie Slough, a short tributary of the Boise River that runs from near where the Simplot plant is in Caldwell, down near Greenleaf.
Yeah.
Dixie River Road runs along it. So, you know, we have these little leftovers from that time and place.
Of course. So I'll tell you a little bit about a guy who was a member of Price's army, who pioneered Dixie. His name was Thomas T. Johnson. Mark, do you remember that picture that I sent you? I was going to send it to you again, but the dude had that sweet beard that goes all the way to the ground.
Do you remember
that photo? Yeah. So apparently it was called the longest beard in America at one point. Like, this is a ZZ Top looking beard. It's beautiful. Like, there's probably things living in that beard, you know? It's so long.
Kind of scrote. It's kind of gross and scraggly.
It's a little scroty.
It's a little scroty, you know? I don't know. So, what kind of scrot we're talking about there, but, man.
Anyway, so I'm going to post that picture with this episode because everybody needs to see this beard. So, but anyway, in 1909, the Idaho Statesman ran an article about him, and they said, Thomas T. Johnson, a pioneer of 1864, of course, he camped on the south side of the Boise River opposite Boise City on July 15th, 1864. Later, he proceeded down the valley and stopped near where the city of Caldwell is now located. This vicinity was then called Dixie in honor of the many Missourians wintering there and was the most thickly settled part of the valley outside of Boise City. You can actually go visit Johnson's cabin in the Van Slyke Agricultural Museum in Memorial Park in Caldwell. But I think the Johnson brothers, they did some other cool, interesting things, so they might get their own episode someday.
I heard that Thomas Johnson was a bit of a Dixie. Jeez, wow, that's a bad joke. Excuse me.
So anyway, Mark, that's all I got on the 1864 Boise City election. So what are you thinking on this whole thing? What are your thoughts? Let us in to your brain.
You know, I think it's great. I think it's great because it opens up so many conversations about, the origins of Idaho, but also kind of what the Civil War was in its murkiness, you know, I'm not talking in terms of right and wrong. I'm talking of just what was. I think a lot of people, just like, you know, with the Revolution, right? When we talk about America during the Revolution or during the Civil War, we always look at our history with an eastward lens until after the Civil War. But we got to talk about what was happening during the Civil War, right? And all these huge moments in American history that impacted what would be Idaho, you know, from the Mormon trekkers in the 1850s that the federal government almost went to war with. But should it have not been for the Civil War, we probably would have had a small war against the Mormons in what? Utah and southern Idaho.
Yeah, in the 1850s. They called it the Mormon War, but there was actually no shots fired. So,
yeah, and then we're talking about, you know, well, so you have these Union supporters and you have these Confederate supporters, or ex-Unionists and Confederate, you know, soldiers in some instances that maybe run away, but they're in towns like Placerville and they're out in the, you know, square and waiting for the news to get in from back east. And then, you know, you have these guys finding out, you know, that the Union or the Confederacy like fought each other and won a battle or lost a battle. And they're out there and they're not killing each other. But back east, they would be killing each other, you know, and maybe, you know, they did kill each other, but for different reasons.
I mean, there was some violence that did occur as a result of, you know, the conflict out west here. I mean, there were fist fights, certainly, about the story of Pinkham.
Pinkham, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a whole crazy story.
What was the guy, Patterson?
Patterson and Pinkham, yeah.
What was his Patterson's first name?
Ferd.
Ferd Patterson. Not Fred.
Yeah.
Ferd. Maybe his parents were, you know, hammered when they came up with his name.
Ferdinand or something, was that his real name?
Yeah. He was a bull of a man.
Yeah. Anyway, Pinkham.
That's a bad joke. You don't get that right there. Sorry.
You've been watching too many kids' movies.
Yeah, well, Pinkham was a federal marshal at one point, right?
But he was also a Union man.
Union man. And he would, like, ride down through Idaho City with, like, the American flag. He would sing Union songs, you know, or hum them. And, you know, he was shot down eventually by Ferd Patterson, who was a strong... He was a outlaw. He was, like, arguably a violent man,
right,
from the start. But he was known to be a Confederate sympathizer, supporter.
Right. And that happened after the war, though, right? But the tension was still there, of course.
Yeah.
I know up in Lewiston during the war, or the early days of the war, there was Talbot, Buffalo, or not Buffalo, what do they call him? Talbot. Anyway, he's buried in Florence, but he actually caused a little brawl with some Union troops in an opera house. Like, they were watching the show, and he kept yelling at these Union troops to kind of egg them on, and ended up shooting the guys. So there was certainly violence. There were fist fights.
Well, Patterson shot Pinkham,
mm-hmm,
at the old Warm Springs resort, which is now, from what I understand, where the
Springs,
Twin Springs, the Springs in Idaho City was. And he died. And so there was this manhunt for Patterson, right? Mm-hmm. And is this the one where they arrested him and they had him in jail? And McConnell comes in, as he says, and stops this second civil war from happening between these Union supporters that wanted his hide.
Yep.
And then the Southern supporters that wanted to keep him from his fate. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I forget, a year or two later, maybe not even that, he's in Walla Walla, Washington, which was a big, you know, town in those days. He's sitting in a barber chair, and somebody that they think was paid by the elite of the vigilantes, the Boise City vigilantes and the Idaho City vigilantes pay it. Mm-hmm. Somebody that was in their employ went in and said, hey, he threatened me, and so I'm going to go in and shoot Patterson.
Which was the way you dealt with things back then.
Yeah, and you could actually say, not in every case did it work, but, oh, this guy threatened me 2 days ago, so I literally jumped the gun and I shot him.
Yeah.
You know, and so these ideas, these sides and rivalries and tensions, like Jeff was saying, travel far beyond the borders of these wars.
Right. And then you have, you know, Florence, one of the, you know, which was like where the second major gold rush happened in Idaho. That town, like, they called their main street the Mason-Dixon line because, you know, it was so split between these, you know, northerners and southerners.
Yeah, and they were sending a message to the other, you know. And
I think the, you know, if these men weren't fighting for their very existence every day, I think there probably would have been more violence.
Yeah, they didn't have time, you know, to always do that. They're trying to make fortunes, and mining was hard work, and you had to be on guard. But, you know, even the Union Block building in Boise, where Moon's Kitchen or whatever, that's a great old restaurant. But
yeah, Mai Tai is there too.
Yeah, Mai Tai, right? Yep. Shoot, that wasn't made until what? Into the 1900s, like 1905 or something around there. I'm not probably exactly correct on that, but that was an intentional slam or slap in the face of Confederates, and that's what, that's like 35-40 years later.
I mean, we're what, 150-ish years removed from the Civil War now, and it seems like in a lot of ways it's still being fought.
That's right, that's why I love when people say, and I actually hate when people say this, so I don't love, but I think it's completely stupid when people are like, "Oh, history doesn't matter. Why does history matter?" Well, sure it does. You know, we're still fighting over these narratives in history, and so it applies to Idaho. And you know, you can get into this great, I think you and I share, Jeff, why we do this podcast among this business together, Idaho History, is because we're interested in not just what people want to be true, but trying to get an idea of what was true and thus what is true.
We do talk a lot of uncomfortable things in this business, in our books and our tours, and you know, it's right.
Yeah, we want to talk about these kind of things on this podcast more. We're going to focus on events that perhaps have been overlooked because they're uncomfortable. You know, from prostitution, violence against women, anything that has to do with the Civil War and the, you know, great conflagration of the United States that was the battle over slavery and its future in the West, to, you know, what, the Snake River War. That's one you wanted to cover, and I think it's a good topic.
Yeah. Basically, you know, removing Native Americans from their land in southern Idaho. Like, yeah, it's a very fraught topic that we'll dive into.
Yeah, we're not the only, and it was tied to the Civil War and the fact that not many people know about the Snake River War, at least the, at all, but the 1864 part, because, you know, the Civil War was going on, or in 1863 the Bear River Massacre,
right?
Which definitely was a massacre, you know, and all these things. So we're
you know, I talked about Jeff Stanford for a little bit on this episode, but there was a whole battle that he fought that's been pretty much erased from history, and that was right after Bear River, like what, 4 or 5 months after Bear River. But we don't talk about that, like that whole massacre, like you could call it a massacre, because up to 100 some natives were, I mean, I think some of these numbers were inflated maybe, but I think that for some reason that one's been forgotten by history.
Oh yeah, and these numbers game, you know, they're definitely political, you know, how many, but the Bear River Massacre is worse than, you know, as far as they're all equally horrible, but as far as numbers, it's the highest number of people massacred than in any other massacre of Native American peoples.
Unfortunately, that one was not forgotten because of the Mormon, because of the Mormons who documented it right after, and you know, kept that, helped keep that narrative alive. So, you know, they do something good.
Whether right or wrong in that, you know, some Mormons, you know, documented it differently than others. But, you know, you can see just what happened on the ground level because of what these Mormon settlers witnessed and described in their letters and tellings of the event.
Exactly. All right. So you got anything else on the 1864 election? Any other thoughts?
Like everything else, it's more complicated than you think, and that's our theme.
And we probably didn't even get into a lot of other aspects that we could have gone into in this episode, and there's just so much that, you know, that's interesting.
Yeah, and that's just in Idaho. And exactly, then what happened outside of Idaho that relates to Idaho.
And then, you know, one of the things I didn't mention is while this election was going on, Sterling Price was actually trying to reinvade Missouri to prevent the re-election of Lincoln from happening. So
yeah,
that's right. All right, so with that, I think we're done. We will see y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. We're Ida History, and you know, follow our podcast, become listeners, and we're going to get right into the thick of a lot of, you know, history you might not have heard about.
All right, perfect. All right, I think with that, we'll give it to Tom.
If you want to get a hold of us, send an email to info@idahistory.com. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Ida History. You can visit us on the web at idahistory.com. Ida History would like to thank our listeners, sponsors, and contributors. If you want to know how you can become a contributor, go to idahistory.com/podcast. Please consider giving us a rating and review on your podcast app. I'm Tom Hart, and this is Devil's County.
You know, I'd like to pause for a second and talk about Umatilla. Yeah. It's a historic town on the Columbia River.
You know it when you drive through because you can see all the bunkers.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? Hanford.
Yeah.
Is that Hanford out there?
I think so.
But I remember a time when I was a younger man and I went to a place. This has nothing to do with history. I just think it's funny. But we went to a place, and I don't know if it was officially called that, but I was a best man for my buddy Zach Fife, and Fife, what's up? Yeah, bro. But we took him, this poor guy, to a place called the Yuma Titty.
Oh.
And it was a strip club in Umatilla, so it, maybe no offense, Umatilla, it wasn't like Showgirls in Seattle, a very classy place. But I went outside to hang out and drink a beer with Zach's brothers-in-law. And I got him a complete lap dance, but he played for the Central Washington football team. He was the center, and he's like 300-something pounds, big dude, slapped me away like nothing, like a fly. Yeah. But they handcuffed him to this pole, and I think his shoulder came dislodged.
Oh, ouch.
So he's sitting there in horrible pain as these all the strippers in the joint are giving him a dance.
Okay.
And so that happened to me in Umatilla.
All right.
Right in this historic heart of clandestine Confederate history.
You know, you could have mentioned that, you know, this is where the supplies and stuff were offloaded from the river for the mines.
Well, the Price's Army really enjoyed the Umatilla.
I'm sure they did.
It's been a strip club since 1864.
An institution.
Yep. Okay. Take off thy frock, Mother Maybelline. So anyway, Jeff, is there any other, you know, proof that these members of Price's Army wound up in Oregon at the Umatilla?